In 1994, Jimmy Breslin underwent surgery to remove an aneurysm from his brain. He was 65 and a New York institution. A newspaper columnist, Breslin knew the city inside out. He would meet a Manhattan hotshot for drinks at some stylish midtown watering hole and know the bartender from his native Queens. He could then write a column about it for the Daily News, later for Newsday, that both hotshot and bartender would want to read. The surgery that saved Jimmy Breslin's life also left him in doubt. The aneurysm was near the language center of the brain, and there was a risk that its removal would claim as collateral damage his ability to write.
I spent 2 days nervously trying to think of a first sentence to start off a column. I picked up a pad and pen, and with an effort that sapped me, I got a few paragraphs down. The next day I picked it up and wrote quite a bit. My wife went back to the hotel and typed it on a computer. When she showed it to me the next morning, she said nothing. I knew that she would wait for a chance to bring up objections, which her face showed would be at least many. She was right. My column read like pure Croatian. I dropped my head in dejection. Then I told myself after several hours, if I knew it was lousy, then I still can think enough to do it right. I started writing again. The subject was the same one that you were reading about, and I am writing, my brain operation.
This is from Jimmy Breslin's new book, I Want to Thank My Brain for Remembering Me. It's about the aneurysm, about his sense of mortality, and about dozens of old columns and stories that came to mind as he neared surgery. Then it's about the operation itself. He studied the Polaroids of himself under the knife. He read hundreds of pages of computer printouts of the notes that doctors and nurses had taken, and he interviewed them.
So I had all their testimony, I had all their records. Then I went back to the hospital in the months following, and I went to about, I would, very conservative, 20 operations. And at the conclusion of all this, I went home and started to write, and I did it the way you write. You know, the old sports writing style, understate to highlight the action you're describing. And it worked out very well. And the thing I liked about it the best is it makes people a little squeamish as they read it.
A little squeamish?
Yeah.
I mean, when you describe the point where your face is, you're a living skeleton without a face that's been peeled away. More than a little squeamish. More than a little squeamish.
Well, that was the idea of it. I love doing that. Do that even with less words, and don't make it so strong, and they'll faint. You know, I like that. That's good. That's what you're supposed to do. You try to get some emotion out of people, get them mad, make them happy, or scare them.
That's the guide to writing a column about what's going on in the city, and also writing a book about your own surgery.
It's the guide to anything. I mean, what is it these newspapers are coming out today with these long, placid stories about nothing? Nobody reads them. There's nothing in a newspaper that gets you mad. When have you read something in a paper that got you really mad? The paper doesn't get mad. The reader doesn't get mad. I don't know what they're doing all day long.
But as you point out on several occasions in this book, your style of writing and your column gave rise to no small amount of imitation.
Yeah, Irish names.
The Irish papers went out.
Papers went out and hired people with Irish names without regard to what they could do. I guess they all went out and hired drunks because when I started, I was drinking a lot.
Was it Robert Maxwell when he bought the news who was so disappointed that you didn't drink anymore when he met you?
No, he was not disappointed. He was furious.
I see.
He came in and he sat down at the Carlisle Hotel and he said, what are you going to have to drink? So I told the waiter, and I said, I'll have a cup of coffee. I was not going to get stewed with this man. I was going to keep my balance. I knew this guy was a monstrous thief, but let's see what was going on here. He proceeded to get bombed. I mean, he didn't know where he was. He tucked his chin on his chest and passed out at the lunch table. Then he woke up and revived himself with several big cold beers and said he would give me $1 million. If I would just come to his newspaper. And then the waiter brought the check, and he didn't move. Neither pen nor plastic appeared from his being. And the waiter stood there, and I said to the fellow with me, Peter Johnson, with my eyes, you know, does this guy want us to pay? Because I ain't going to pay. And Finally, he went into his pocket, Maxwell, and he paid in cash. So we walked down on the sidewalk, and I said to the fella with me, Peter Johnson, is this fella broke? And he said, I was thinking the same thing. The answer is he was.
He was, as it turned out, yes.
The man was broke. He's telling me he's going to give me $1 million, and he didn't have a lunch money. I spoke to Charlie Wilson, who was going to be the head of the New York Daily News. He arrived here in the morning from London, went into the city room, and they gave him a bullet and flash. Maxwell just went over the side in Spain, and he's dead. Charlie got up, left the building, went to the airport, and flew back to London. And the last time I spoke to him, he was at the London Mirror. He said, I'm working 16 hours a day. We all are trying to pay the bankers for what this fella stole.
The bankruptcy that Maxwell left behind.
Wow, we left everybody in disarray. And imagine now, my wife and I always talk about that. Supposing the guy gave us $1 million, right? And we woke up in the morning and found out it was stolen pension funds.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you do? What do you do in that case?
Yeah. Well, I got to give it back. That would have been something. To give that money back. I think then you were entitled to go out and kill Maxwell if you could find him. You really were. I mean, there were some rules you were allowed to do it. You're not supposed to touch any of God's children, but anybody to put you in a hole for $1 million like that, he comes from the devil. He doesn't come from God. Mm-hmm. So you're allowed to do what you want, whatever you feel like with him.
More than a year and a half after your surgery,
yes.
Given all of the apprehension you had at the beginning as to what this might do. Is there any, I mean, do you sense anything at all different about yourself? I mean,
yeah.
you do?
Sure.
How?
There was an appreciation of life around you. I'll begin with my job, the job I like. I do. I love to write. I'm not going to do columns now. I'm just going to stay home and write a novel for the rest of this year. But just before I went in, a surgeon, one of the surgeons who helped us decide where we should go to get the operation, his name is Dr. Dan Coit at Memorial Sloan Kettering. I said, well, I guess I'll come out writing backwards. He said, no, you could come out better. Think of it that way. So I went in and I came out and I've looked at the stuff I've done since then and I said, he's right, I did come out better. They hit a wire inside somehow that made sentences come out faster.
You think so?
They did. Oh, no question. While he was at it, he could have tripped a science thing in there and I could do physics too, but he didn't have time, I guess. It's a very good thing.
As with baseball players, when they go to the Hall of Fame, there's some choices to which uniform they should be remembered in. Which newspaper column? Are you a Daily News columnist in your mind?
Well, that was most of my time was spent there, yeah. I mean, to really identify you for all time, it'd be Costello's Bar.
Jimmy Breslin, his new book is called I Want to Thank My Brain for Remembering Me.